This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Benazir Bhutto, the opponent of, let me bring in Ellen Ratner to characterize this whole thing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News, our regular correspondent. Benazir Bhutto was just assassinated. And Ellen, you knew Benazir Bhutto. You interviewed her the last time, I think, was 3 years ago. First of all, give us for those people who may not be familiar with the current situation in Pakistan, the thumbnail sketch.
Well, first of all, yeah, she was also a contributor. I don't know that she was a paid contributor to Fox News, so I actually saw her in the Washington Bureau. And that's actually how I followed up after I interviewed her. When I interviewed her, she was at a friend's house in Potomac, Maryland, just like a regular, very nice house. Mm-hmm. Not huge, not whatever, but she was just staying there. She took off her headscarf, except when we took a photo. Mm-hmm. And she was the nicest person on the planet. People at Fox liked her. She was never somebody who, you know, pushed arrogantly anywhere, as a lot of people who are of much less station than she does. My cousin Richard went to Harvard with her, too, so I'll talk about that in a second. But first of all, as you know, Musharraf had put her husband in jail, called it corruption. She actually lived in Dubai with her children.
Well, and
then
recently,
8 weeks ago, went back to Pakistan.
Right. And wasn't she technically under house arrest? I mean, right
for
now?
For a while, I don't know that she was right now. Obviously, she wasn't right now because she was out. He put the house arrest on. He put it off. Now, there was a lot of speculation that she actually had her brother murdered. And there's this amazing scene after he dies where she comes to, I guess, his hospital room or the funeral home or wherever, where barefoot, which is apparently a Muslim custom. And I don't believe that she had her brother murdered. She does not really seem like the type. She was a preppy at Harvard. And when I interviewed her, she said to me, she said, you know, Ellen, the problem with Musharraf is he is going to let extremism happen. He's going to say yes, yes, yes to the United States, and then he's going to look the other way, and he is going to let extremism continue on.
Right.
And the United States is going to be bowled over by this guy.
Well, as has said, I mean, ever since 9/11, he was right after 9/11, 9/12. Basically, at that point, our relationship with Musharraf was sort of dicey, and Bush embraced him.
I've always called him Saddam Light.
Yeah, and Bush immediately embraced him and said, "Okay, he's our guy, he's our ally." And the fact of the matter is that apparently Osama bin Laden has gone to Pakistan and has been living in Pakistan all along, and having a fine time. Thank you very
much.
Now,
she has been working with the United States and the CIA and whoever before she went back to Pakistan. I think that's pretty well known.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is Musharraf, at the very least, did not protect her.
Let me lay out a couple of the conspiracy theories, as they were, some of the concerns that are bouncing around, and I'm seeing them bouncing all over the place. I mean, even oddly enough, you go over to some of the conservative message boards, and already there's all this speculation how this is going to help Rudy Giuliani. You know, the Republicans see an opportunity in this. But setting that aside, here we have a country, 160-some-odd million people, as I recall, seven major ethnic and linguistic groups in Pakistan. And there's theory number one, that Musharraf had something to do with her assassination. And then there's the opposing theory that Musharraf actually would be hurt by her assassination. He had something to do with it, or he allowed it to happen sort of thing, you know, sort of like Bush in 9/11, you know, look the other way. That theory is that by getting rid of a political rival and getting rid of somebody that the extremists hated, that he killed two birds with one stone. Lousy metaphor, but you get the point. On the other hand, if he did that, if he, you know, if he did allow this to happen knowingly, There was tremendous political risk for him in that she was very popular in Pakistan, and there could be enormous blowback that's going to end up in his lap. And I'm curious your thoughts.
I think actually both theories. I mean, I think that he very well could have allowed it to happen, as I said, at the very least, and maybe more actively, taking a gamble.
Yeah.
And I don't know, if that's true or not. And I have not, the one thing I have not followed is whether he let her husband out of jail. But I also know, most people may not remember, and it's actually in the movie Charlie Wilson's War that Zia had her father hanged.
Yes. Yeah. The previous military strongman who overthrew a democratically elected government, which was her father.
Exactly.
And so, if, now this is interesting, if Musharraf played a role in this or if he didn't, either way, I mean, the speculation that I'm seeing, pardon me, it is all this stuff flying around in front of me. The speculation that I'm seeing that Musharraf was behind it, and some of this actually, you're seeing some of this on international bulletin boards, particularly coming out of not necessarily Pakistan, but out of the region, is that the place where she was speaking had very, very tight security. You had to go through metal detectors to get in, no weapons, no bombs, you know, bomb-sniffing dogs and all this stuff. But there was only one exit. And, you know, it's like, you know, leading somebody out of a funnel. It's like leading the sheep to slaughter kind of thing. And that one exit was an absolute setup. And it could have been organized in a way that had multiple exits. And this was something that was done by Musharraf's security service, that was set up. That's the conspiracy theory that I'm reading out on the Middle Eastern blogs, shall we say. Thoughts on that.
Given Musharraf's personality, anything is possible. Look, this guy gave AQ Khan a slap on the wrist. And again, I just have to go back to Benazir Bhutto's words to me, which is, you will find that no matter what anybody says, he is going to say yes, yes, yes to the United States and look completely the other way when it comes to terrorism.
Yeah.
And she described him as ruthless. It really is pretty amazing. And my heart also goes out to her children. She's got, I believe, two young children.
Yeah, yeah. And
who were living with her in Dubai
and to Pakistan. I mean, you know, she's been accused of corruption and all these kind of things, and we don't know to what extent all of that is real. But this for Pakistan might be kind of a Bobby Kennedy assassination moment.
It's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens on that. It's a very volatile country in a lot of ways, from Danny Pearl to, you know, it also had an earthquake, as you recall, and we actually sent Greg Gorman, our correspondent at the time, went to the earthquake and was able to get up into the mountains and said that actually the government did a very good job in terms of trying to bring food, et cetera, to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They were really quite there for people, but what's also interesting is I've gotten like three emails, which I forwarded to you in the last hour, and it's all the old Democrats that we're hearing from. So far have not really heard, the foreign policy, what's the name, the group in New York?
Yeah.
Everybody. They're sort of in the
Council
middle,
on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, Council on Foreign Relations is doing a press conference at 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
But I haven't really heard a whole lot from the Bush administration other than the fact that there's going to be a gaggle in Texas about this.
Right,
but,
right. And they're expressing, you know, concern or regrets. But one of the comments that really struck me on one of the international bulletin boards, again, I just this morning, I mean, I read the news stories and then I spent an hour or so just hitting as many websites that might have something to do with this where people can just comment and reading the comments on it. And one person who's a regular contributor and fairly well educated about the Middle East, but not anybody whose name anybody would recognize, made the comment that, you know, there's very real concern in the Middle East right now that this could be an Archduke Ferdinand moment. Archduke Ferdinand, of course,
World War One.
Yeah,
Sarajevo.
The assassination of Archduke Ferdinand triggering World War One, seemingly, you know, without reason. Is Pakistan that unstable?
I from people who have been there have come back. I believe it is pretty unstable, certainly, as you know, when the province is close to Afghanistan, it's it's not even controlled by the government.
Right.
So that's number one. And two, if you really have followed Benazir Bhutto's life and career, as I actually have, you realize that this woman, I mean, she was a preppy at Harvard. She was like everybody else, wore her hair in a ponytail, wore pink. People used to call her Pinky. And she really has become a martyr.
Yeah, yeah. So the other shoe may drop.
And people view her that way.
Yeah, so we're gonna keep an eye on the situation. And Ellen, anything pops up, let us know, will you?
Will do.
Give us a shout. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We're seeing things in a different way. And God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise.
We're living on the 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. In the second hour of our program, by the way, Marjorie Cohn is going to drop by. She's president of the National Lawyers Guild, Professor Thomas Jefferson School of Law, talking about, you know, what's up with the many and multiple crimes of the Bush administration and where are we at with doing something about them. In our third hour, Tim Carpenter is going to drop by. He's the National Director of Progressive Democrats of America, as well as Rob Call from opednews.com and Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress. So it's going to be an interesting day. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Drop by our live chat room if you'd like, tomhartman.com. We are live and on the air here. It's the 27th of December. And Ken in New York City. Ken, New York, New York. Hey, Ken, what are your thoughts on all of this today?
Hello.
Hey, Ken, you're on the air.
Yes. Bhutto. I believe Musharraf is in more trouble with her being killed because I think it's Osama bin Laden that took her out. He's been trying to take Musharraf out. He wants to get rid of all the popular leaders because he's got a shot at the radicals taking over that country that have nukes.
Yeah.
And I think Musharraf recognizes Musharraf has finally kind of made a tacit deal with him because we betrayed Musharraf. He knew when he joined with us that the United States would take out Osama bin Laden exponentially, right away, take him out. And what happened? We let him get away. He got into the mountains. He's bigger now than he was before. We're hated more than we've ever been in history. And there's a good shot that we're in deep trouble because he can get hold of Pakistan and the nukes, and Musharraf is fighting for his life.
Yeah, I think it's bigger than just bin Laden, though. I don't think that he is this giant puppet master, that, you know, larger-than-life figure that he's constantly portrayed as. You look back at Mubarak in Egypt, for example. They were having elections in Egypt. And he basically had to suspend the elections because it looked like and this is not the first time that this has happened in one of these countries in the Middle East, because it looked like under democratic elections, they were going to end up electing what would have turned Egypt into a Sharia state, Islamic state. And that's what you get when you have the only institution in the country that is building schools, that's building hospitals, that's providing education, that is providing food to the poor, that is providing housing, in fact, in many cases, to the poor. When the only institution doing that is the religious institution.
Right.
Which is the 1,000 points of light that George Herbert Walker Bush talked about and George Bush's, faith-based initiatives. When only the radical religious elements are the ones who are providing for the needs of society, society tends to turn to the radical religious elements and say, okay, you're the ones who are taking care of us. We're on your side. We're with you. You know, thanks for being with us.
Right.
And that's what Hamas has done. That's what Hezbollah has done. You look throughout the Middle East and this is where the terrible mistake that we have made, and this is what Al-Qaeda has done, and the terrible mistake that we have made And by we, I'm speaking of, in to some extent, the entire Western world, although the United States, particularly since the election of, or since the installation, the selection of George Bush by the Supreme Court in 2000, has been leading the charge on this. Of, although you watch Charlie Wilson's War, it's the take-home message at the end of the movie, is that by saying, we'll provide you with guns, we'll provide you with weapons, we'll provide you with tasers, we'll support your torture, but we will not provide you with food, we will not provide you with education, we will not provide you with hospitals. It opens the door for Hamas and Hezbollah and organizations like this to come in, or Al-Qaeda, to come in and say, okay, we're going to do this, and paves the way for radicals. Can you spot on and well said. Thank you very much. Doug in Denver. Hey, Doug, your thoughts on this?
Hey, Tom. Correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't mind being told that I am wrong, but isn't this a good chunk of the foreign policy that we have right now?
What do you mean?
Well, we all know Bush is an idiot, and he doesn't have any intelligence to do the right policies to begin with. We all know that. But isn't he partly responsible for keeping Musharraf around and helping him and all that? Am I wrong?
Not partly responsible. I'd say largely responsible.
Okay, thank you then. Okay, I was being real conservative on that part of it. But I'm thinking if the wrong people get those nukes, what's going to happen?
And well, that's also what Bush is thinking. I mean, Bush, what's the old LBJ said it about, remember who, he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB.
Right.
And that's been the Bush administration's take on Musharraf up to this point. At least he's providing stability. And that's true of, this King Faisal. I mean, it's right across the Middle East. That's true. And not just the Middle East, by the way. I mean, that's how we used to view the dictatorships in Central and South America back in the 50s and 60s.
Well, here's another thing that I got to thinking about while I was on hold. We all kind of, in our back of our minds, remember that nuclear movement from the north to that naval base or whatever.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this could possibly be used for the wrong country, because it was going to be used for the first wrong country with Iran. What's going to happen if the wrong people get
these
nukes?
I don't think so, Doug. I can't imagine that we would drop nukes on Pakistan. 27 minutes past the hour.
And the uninformed can be easily led astray. And those that cannot connect the dots, hey, look the other way. People believe what they want to believe when it makes no sense at all. And I wish you all along sideline and the strength to walk out.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour in our dimly lit studio. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. It is getting strange out there. Very strange. Sometimes you wonder about these Republican candidates. Mike Huckabee. Rudy Giuliani. In just a moment, we will share with you some of the campaign ads. Or at least some alacrums of the campaign ads that Huckabee and Giuliani are running over on the internets. But right now, P.J. Crowley is with us. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. P.J. and has been on this program a number of times. P.J., welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be back.
Thank you. I'm curious if you could give us your overview on what happened today in Pakistan. Outside of the obvious, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. We've had some discussion about this over the last half hour. And where do you think this is going to go? And what do you think really is the story behind the story?
Well, I think, first of all, if you think about global political violence and extremism, outcomes in Pakistan are, in my mind, more important than outcomes in Iraq. Many of the attacks that we've seen in recent years in Europe, for example, around the world, have links back to Pakistan. It is where the remnants of Al-Qaeda Central are located, where they've been able to reconstitute some elements of their, terrorism infrastructure. So what happens from this point forward, I think, will have far more direct impact on our security long term than what happens in Iraq. So, with that background, Obviously, this is a tremendous challenge for Pakistan and in particular for the Musharraf government. The first thing that Musharraf government has to do is have a credible investigation of what took place. And I think President Musharraf may have to acknowledge that probably somewhere in the background here, at least there's some complicity among Pakistani security forces and intelligence forces that have tolerated or supported extremist elements in Pakistan for a number of years. The most important and difficult decision he has is what to do about the January 8th elections that were scheduled. Benazir Bhutto was a figure that was trying to push Pakistan back towards more democratic rule, and obviously she's gone. So how they rebuild, you know, a process that the Pakistani people can have faith and confidence in will be very, very difficult.
We're talking with P.J. Crowley. He was Special Assistant to the President of the United States for National Security Affairs, Senior Director of Public Affairs for the National Security Council, currently Senior Fellow and Director of Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress. There are a number of conspiracy theories flying around, P.J., that vary from Musharraf was behind this, there was only one exit from the stadium, his security people could have set it up so there were multiple exits, this was a setup, this was leading the land to slaughter, to Al-Qaeda was behind this, to the radical Islamists were behind this, and Musharraf didn't want it to happen, to the radical Islamists were behind this, and Musharraf did want it to happen. And there's all these kind of variations on what brought this about. And some of them are suggesting that Musharraf might have, you know, sort of like Bush receiving more than 50 warnings that 9/11 was coming and basically doing nothing about it, that he might have decided just to let it happen and figure he'd roll the dice and see what happens. Your thoughts on all of this stuff?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, let's recall that Musharraf himself has been the target of multiple assassination attempts, and that Benazir Bhutto survived an attempt assassination the night she arrived back in country last fall. I find no credibility that Musharraf himself or the government directly would have a hand in this. I think it's far more likely that you know, you'll find that there might be some elements that at least had in the past supported the people who were responsible for this. I think you probably the leading candidate has to be, you know, Al Qaeda or its sympathizers. But clearly, what, you know, the government will have to take responsibility for the fact that, and Benazir Bhutto herself had criticized the government for not providing adequate security to her or to other candidates for public office. And I think that, you know, part of what Musharraf does going forward, he'll have to acknowledge that the government could have done more to protect Benazir Bhutto in particular and the political process that was underway in Pakistan.
Yeah, there were people at the hospital this morning shouting against him.
Sure, that is the challenge. Obviously, you know, this kind of incident will pull Pakistan apart at the seams if Musharraf fails to adequately respond to it. There will be lots of people who are unwilling to to believe whatever he says unless it's clear that this was is a credible investigation. I mean, Benazir Bhutto herself in recent days had suggested that Musharraf and his supporters would try to take advantage of the election, skew them in the direction of his political party. So right now what you have is you have a fundamental challenge in terms of the faith and confidence that the Pakistani people have in their government, in their government institutions, in their political processes, and this will be Musharraf's greatest test, is can he come across as a credible figure to help lead Pakistan to a stable situation. And unfortunately right now, because of what's transpired in Pakistan over the past 6 months and his own efforts to sack the Supreme Court to ensure he could stay in office for another term, this happens at a time where Musharraf's credibility inside Pakistan is at an all-time low.
At least as a small-D Democrat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, this is going to be a great test for Pakistan and for the elements of civil society that we believe has to be part of Pakistan's future.
Well, in that context raises a larger question. And the larger question is, to what extent is democracy viable in a country that doesn't have a strong middle class and doesn't have strong political social institutions. What we've seen, you know, we saw Mubarak essentially suspending the democratic electoral process because it looked like the conservative religious, the Islamists were going to win in Egypt. We see, you know, we're supporting Saudi Arabia, a dictatorship. We're supporting a number of dictatorships in the Middle East on the assumption that they're the only ones who can deal with Islamic radicalism. It was the main reason why we supported Saddam Hussein for so long. And there is this, at the very end of Charlie Wilson's War, there's that point, given, acknowledging all the deficiencies, the factual deficiencies of the movie, nonetheless, at the end of the movie, there's this very poignant moment where they talk about, you know, okay, we've got the Soviets out, we've got to go in and rebuild the hospitals. And it's Hamas, it's Hezbollah, it's Al-Qaeda who are building hospitals, who are building schools, who are feeding people, rather than us, rather than democratic governments. To what extent is democracy even viable, or do we have to fall back on the old canard of he may be an SOB, but at least he's our SOB?
Well, I think that is the great riddle of Pakistan, because you look now, you know, their origins are the same as their neighbors next door in India. And in India, you do have, with struggles that India has, you do have a middle class that is continuing to build a stable society.
But arguably, India just elected a Hindu extremist, a Hindu nationalist.
Yeah, but I reject the idea that the democracy cannot succeed in Pakistan. But certainly, when you look at U.S. policy towards a country like Pakistan, we have tended to support individuals, such as Musharraf, or in the past, such as General Zia when he was the leader of Pakistan during Charlie Wilson's War, we have tended to support rather than to build effective institutions of government.
Right. It seems like the Marshall Plan was the most effective. The Marshall Plan was the most effective foreign policy thing that we did in the 20th century.
And in fact, we helped build enduring institutions. That would extend beyond any government or any individual, and that's what Pakistan has to do. And that's the conundrum about, in November when Musharraf declared emergency rule, he eliminated the Supreme Court led by in essence a political competitor, Supreme Court Chief Justice Chaudhry, and the response there. I mean, that was the best dressed demonstration you ever saw. That was Pakistani civil society objecting to increasingly autocratic rule by the Musharraf government. And we, the United States, continue to lend our support to Musharraf, and I don't think we adequately lent our support to Pakistani civil society. And now the conundrum is that we have to once again turn to Musharraf as the stabilizing figure in the short term, even though he is viewed within Pakistan as an increasingly autocratic ruler and is deeply unpopular. So it will be vitally important that we quietly give Musharraf some advice, and that Musharraf himself rise to a level in terms of support of democracy that he has been unable or unwilling to do over 7 years.
Right. But the extent to which we support, I mean, we're spending arguably $1 trillion in Iraq. If that kind of money had been put into building schools and hospitals and essentially competing on the ground with all these right-wing Islamist groups, it seems like we could defeat them in the battle for the hearts and minds of people in the region.
You're exactly right. What we're seeing is the failure to invest adequately in Pakistan, or the failure to invest adequately next door in Afghanistan, and that has cost us and will continue to cost us until we have a greater balance.
Amen. P.J. Crowley, Senior Fellow and Director of Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thank you, P.J.
A pleasure.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
What's Bush got to do with it? Not much. Or maybe everything. I guess it depends on your perspective. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Nine minutes before the hour. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. And listen in particular for your local sponsors. And let them know you're listening. Let them know that you like the show. And we were talking during the last segment before P.J. Crowley came on about our crazy alert. Yeah, and let's revisit that just very briefly. So here we are. It's a spoof ad, right? Well, let me tell you, just right up front, this is a YouTube spoof ad. But here it is, a Rudy Giuliani ad from the Internet.
Ask yourself a few questions about security. When John McCain cheated on his first wife, did he take care of his mistresses and provide them with top-of-the-line security?
I don't think so.
The answer is no. Did Mitt Romney even bother to cheat on his wife?
Don't think so.
Doesn't seem like it. And since Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee began dating Chuck Norris, has he spent any state money at all to keep Chuck Norris safe?
Maybe.
Not one dime.
Whoa.
Who's the only Republican worth cheating with? Rudy Giuliani.
Ah, our guy!
When he was mayor of New York and had his most recent affair, Rudy Giuliani provided New York City's finest as security for his mistress. The NYPD gave her rides and even walked her dog.
Seriously, he had the police walk his mistress's dog.
Yeah.
And what did she pay for all this? No more than any other taxpayer. Because when it comes to security or mistresses, Rudy Giuliani believes there's no price that's too high. This parody was not approved by Rudolph Giuliani.
No, no prices.
Yes, 9/11, 9/11, 9/11.
Yes, no price too high for you to pay. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Andre in South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Tom. It's really good to speak to you.
Well, thanks for calling.
Now, I have a question. You know, I've been listening to your last guest and a few callers, and it seems that people are trying to spin it that Osama bin Laden has such great power in the Middle East right now. And I just wanted to mention that after the invasion of Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda escaped to Pakistan.
Right.
Now, they've been there for 5 years now. No one's been able to get them. Musharraf is certainly not, you know, saying martial law, let's find Al-Qaeda and get him out of the country. He did that to Bhutto. So what I'm trying to figure out is if Condoleezza Rice goes to Pakistan on a regular basis, and obviously there's no great search for Osama bin Laden, then the only true radical out of that whole group would be Bhutto. She wanted to get rid of Al-Qaeda.
Right.
And Musharraf may say that he wants to, but certainly he's had plenty of opportunity. 5 years is quite a great deal of time.
Right. Look at what he says, not what he does.
That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and good point, Andre, and thank you for calling and making it. And the you know, the whole idea of, you know, who's the real radical here? Well, the real radical, you know, Bhutto was calling for democracy. There's also this whole, you know, shock doctrine theory, the Naomi Klein theory, that Musharraf is using the ongoing problems of Pakistan to enrich his corporate cronies and to strengthen the corporate institutions in Pakistan at the expense of the middle class, and that, A, fuels radicalism, and, B, it fuels his buddies. So, you know, who knows? Let's see, Paul in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Paul.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, and the same to you, Paul.
You know, I know I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I can't help being curious that if this we witness today, the price of Bush's posterity by this is what it cost us to get the president of Pakistan to release bin Laden.
Yeah, you know, this, well, frankly, I doubt that that's the case, but I would argue with the beginning of your point that this is the price of Bush's posterity. I mean, let's keep in mind that George Bush in 1999, 2 years before he was installed as president by the Supreme Court, before he had announced that he was going to run for president, in 1999, and thank you, Paul, for the comment, George Bush made a comment to Mickey Herskowitz, his biographer, his official biographer, hired by the Bush family, an old family friend, who wrote the first draft of A Charge to Keep, George Bush's autobiography, which he didn't write himself. They went through two different ghostwriters for it. And Mickey Herskowitz was the first. And Mickey later on publicly made this statement. This, by the way, this is Cindy Sheehan speaking before John Conyers Commission, laying out what Mickey Herskowitz said.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. And so you know that George Bush went into office wanting to invade Iraq because he thought it would give him political power. And it did. You had Dick Cheney going into office wanting to invade Iraq because it would double the stock price of Halliburton that he owned hundreds of thousands of stock options and all his buddies were invested in. And it did. You had Condoleezza Rice going in, a former director of Chevron that had an oil tanker named after her, wanting to invade Iraq and Afghanistan. It would increase the value of her stock and her companies, and it did. The list could go on and on. I mean, we had Hamid Karzai, you know, the Unocal executive and consultant, you know, thinking, you know, wouldn't it be a fine thing if we took down Afghanistan? And, you know, the famous offer to the Afghan, to the Taliban, you know, we'll give you a carpet of bombs or a carpet of gold, your choice. And they said, we'll pass on the gold. They got the bombs. It helped him out and his buddies. I mean, everybody seemed to win in this except democracy and us, the taxpayers. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Marjorie Cohen on the line with us. She is the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's the author of her most recent book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Marjorie Cohen, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Hello. Hey,
hi.
There you are. Eureka.
I said my pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I wanted to get your thoughts on a whole wide variety of things that are going on right now. There's a couple of pieces over at your website, MarjorieCohen.com, Marjorie, MarjorieCohen.com, that I want to get to as well. But first, this whole thing with Jose Rodriguez, the former head of the CIA's clandestine service. He says he's not going to become the fall guy for this administration. What's going on here? What's your take on this? Where do you think this might lead?
Well, this is real interesting because the Senate and House Intelligence Committees immediately convened investigations into who gave the order to destroy those CIA tapes of the torturous interrogations. And at first, Michael Mukasey, the new attorney general, refused to cooperate. He says, I want to finish my own internal investigation first. And this is right. This is pretty much unheard of. But then there was a big firestorm in the media. So the CIA said, okay, we're going to produce the documents and the testimony of John Rizzo, who's the acting general counsel of the CIA. But the decision to destroy the tapes allegedly was made by Rodriguez, who was chief of the Directorate of Operations, the CIA's clandestine service. And it's not clear whether his bosses are going to allow him to testify or whether they're going to claim executive privilege. Now, the Sunday Times of London just reported that Rodriguez might seek immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying before the House Intelligence Committee. And if that's the case and he makes the decision to testify based upon immunity, that he won't be prosecuted for anything that he testifies to, he could finger people all the way up the chain of command to the commander-in-chief, and that's George W. Bush. So this could really be hot.
Why is it that over and over again we have these stories come out that sound so much like a mafia trial?
It does. It really does. And if you look at who Abu Zubaydah is, one of the two men who was waterboarded, denied medication, subjected to freezing cold temperatures, and these videotapes that depict probably the torture of both Abu Zubaydah and al-Nashiri go on for hundreds of hours. We're talking about hundreds of hours of these torturous interrogations. And Bush defends these, what he calls harsh interrogation techniques, because he said that we got great intelligence from Abu Zubaydah. He's the one who fingered Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. But according to investigative journalist Ron Susskind, who wrote a book called 1% Doctrine in 2006, it was actually a walk-in who came in and turned in Mohammed or led the CIA to Mohammed in return for a $25 million reward. Right. Abu Zubaydah is schizophrenic, and according to one of the FBI's leading experts on al-Qaeda, he knew very little about al-Qaeda operations.
In fact, it was widely known among his compatriots that he was basically that he was schizophrenic. They referred to him as crazy, and he was constantly on the phone. I think is one of the phrases that they, you know, he was one of these people who was compulsively talking. He wasn't taken seriously, and he really didn't know that much.
Right, and keep in mind that Bush was very involved in the interrogation of Zubaydah, even though all of this information about Zubaydah's instability, that he really wasn't a high al-Qaeda official, were communicated to Bush and Cheney. But Bush actually scolded George Tenet, the former director of the CIA, and he said, quote, this is Bush talking to Tenet, I said Zubaydah was important. You're not going to let me lose face on this, are you? And so here you have Bush really monitoring closely the interrogation of Zubaydah. You think that he hasn't seen some of those tapes? You think he didn't know anything about the destruction of those tapes? When at least four high White House officials, lawyers actually, participated in the discussions about whether or not to destroy these tapes. Alberto Gonzalez, Harriet Myers, David Addington, who's a Cheney's chief hitman, and John Bellinger, legal hitman, I should say, or illegal hitman.
Yeah. So we're talking about potential, another potential impeachable offense.
Well, not just an impeachable offense. We're talking about real crimes here. We're talking about criminal activity.
Right.
Not
just getting it on with an intern.
Right, right. I mean, impeachment is one thing, and I certainly would be thrilled to see them impeached, but we're talking about investigation of a cover-up. This kind of makes Watergate pale by comparison. There are other things, too, here, and that is that two former CIA officials, Vincent Canestrano and Larry Johnson, say, and they've had experience with this kind of thing, and they say it's very unlikely that Rodriguez made this decision to destroy the tapes on his own.
Right. Which is why his testimony would finger others and you know, echo up the chain.
Right. Also, something that hasn't come out much, but is bedrock Supreme Court jurisprudence. And that is that the government has a duty to provide criminal defendants with any evidence the government has that might tend to exonerate the defendant or impeach the prosecutor. Zubaydah and al-Nashiri are going to go before these military commissions to be tried for crimes. They're undoubtedly going to raise their torture as a defense, but there's no evidence of that torture because it's been destroyed. Also, Zacharias Moussaoui tried to subpoena al-Zubaydah to testify at his trial in 2003. And on May the 9th, 2003, two assistant U.S. attorneys lied to a U.S. district court judge who was presiding over Moussaoui's trial. The judge asked them whether the interrogations, this is of Zubaydah and others, are being recorded in any format. This is 2003. Remember, those tapes were made in 2002. Right. Whether the interrogations are being recorded in any format, the U.S. attorneys said no.
Was that an innocent lie, or was that a lie of knowledge?
They say, oh, we made a mistake. We were relying on information from the CIA. But they're responsible for what the CIA tells them. Then the tapes were denied to the 9/11 Commission, who asked for according to co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Keene, he said, we asked for every single thing they had. Look, even if we haven't asked for something, if it's pertinent to our investigation, make it available to us, they told the CIA. And Hamilton, the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, said the CIA clearly obstructed the commission's investigation. At the same time, the ACLU filed a Freedom of Information Act request seeking the records of the treatment of all the detainees in U.S. custody abroad since 9/11, and the CIA has still not complied with that, and there is a motion to hold the CIA in contempt pending in federal court. But I think probably the most important thing that we should be concerned with here is whether or not Michael Mukasey, the Attorney General, can really conduct an impartial criminal investigation. Certainly the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees are investigating, and they're going ahead with their investigation.
Right.
But Michael Mukasey, who tried to stop those congressional investigations, should be appointing a special counsel.
Yes.
Because Justice Department regulations says that when a criminal investigation is warranted, when there's a conflict of interest in the Department of Justice and the public interest would be served, then the Attorney General has to appoint an outside special counsel.
But isn't that what happened when Ken Starr got appointed? And isn't that a road that the Republicans are looking at going, oh, no, we don't want to go down that road?
Oh, they don't. No, because Ken Starr, no, they know where that could lead. That led to impeachment. That was a Democrat who was impeached in that instance. That was Clinton. But listen to this. When he was a federal court judge, Michael Mukasey issued the warrant for Jose Padilla, which was based partly on information from, guess who, Abu Zubaydah.
Oh,
now,
my.
It's not clear whether Mukasey knew that Zubaydah's statements were obtained by torture, but because he issued the warrant, Mukasey has a conflict of interest.
He has
in
to recuse himself.
In the law, we say either a real or apparent conflict of interest. Either one means that he should disqualify himself.
Right.
And Congress should put the mechanism in place for the appointment of a special independent prosecutor. That's what we should be talking about right now. And in fact, I just want to mention that the American Freedom Campaign has launched a project called American Lawyers Defending the Constitution, and more than 1,300 lawyers, including Bruce Fein, who used to be in the Reagan administration,
mm-hmm.
former
He's
Governor Mario Cuomo, Erwin Chemerinsky, Derek Bell, many of us have signed a statement calling for investigations, calling on John Conyers, the House Judiciary Chairman, and Patrick Leahy, the Senate Judiciary Chairman, to investigate, and that these investigations should go where they must, including into the offices of the President and Vice President. And should these hearings demonstrate laws have been broken, we support all legal and congressional actions necessary to maintain the Constitution.
Are there links to that off MarjorieCohen.com?
Yes. Well, AmericanFreedomCampaign.org/lawyers if you want to sign the statement.
Great.
AmericanFreedomCampaign.org/lawyers.
Thank you so much. Marjorie Cohen. Speaking of Republican crimes, it doesn't get much more bizarre than this. There's a great post about this over at the top of the Daily Kos, crooksandliars.com. Other websites are starting to pick up on this. It'll be interesting to see how long it takes before the corporate media in the United States picks it up, because it is a Republican crime and because it highlights a long history of Republican crimes that have to do with election fraud, not voter fraud, not individuals like, you know, Ann Coulter registering at a realtor's address, but election fraud, the wholesale theft of elections, as is increasingly now apparent, happened in Ohio, for example, in 2004, as we know happened in 2000 in Florida. The election fraud. Here we have Kris Kobach. He used to be John Ashcroft's lawyer. He's now the chairman of the Kansas Republican Party. And he sent out an email to all of the Republicans in Kansas last Thursday. It was titled, Kansas Republican Party Year in Review. And this is pretty amazing. He said, well, here's an exact quote from it. To date, the Kansas GOP has identified and caged more voters in the last 11 months than the previous 2 years. And he puts an exclamation point after that. And caged? Hey, wait a minute. The Republican Party is operating under a dissent decree. It's against the law for them to do caging. I mean, caging is where you send out letters to people non-returnable letters, returnable letters, non-disposable letters. They must be returned to the sender if they're not delivered. You send out letters, or either that are not that must come back, first class mail. It must come back so that you find out if people have moved or if they've gone off to Iraq, for example, or if they've gone off to college or something like that. They're not at that address right now. Maybe they're on vacation. Or you send out a letter to somebody saying, if you don't reply to this, we will assume that you are not actually registered to vote, which is a more common tactic for the Republican Party. And as a consequence of that, thousands of people, for example, in Ohio, in the 2004 election, we know that just in Cincinnati, 35,000 voters were caged. Where? Just by coincidence in minority and urban areas. So here we have, and you know, frankly, I mean, the amazing thing to me is I have talked with Democratic politicians who didn't know what the word caging meant. I think that they're starting to figure it out. But Kris Kobach, the chairman of the Kansas GOP, the Kansas Republican Party, fellow Republicans, 2007 has been a busy year for the Kansas Republican Party. We've taken the last 11 months to rebuild our party operations, make technology updates, build our fundraising database, and identify voters. And there's the kicker. We are already getting to launch our official Republican Party blog to further head the spread the positive actions of all Republican elected officials. Our voter identification system is up and running, giving us the ability to effectively mobilize voters and turn them out to vote on Election Day. To date, the Kansas GOP has identified and caged more voters in the last 11 months than the previous 2 years. You recall Sarah Taylor talking about how Karl Rove's number two guy, Tiny Dr. Tim, was engaged in a caging effort. Speaking about this before Congress, and half of the people in Congress who were listening to that in that committee were going, huh, what's she talking about? Nobody even asked a follow-up question. But caging? Caging? Voter caging is a way of suppressing the vote. It's very simple. John Conyers, for example. Caging in the context of elections is not an issue of the mail at all. Voter caging in the context of elections means blocking voters out, choosing whole lists of voters whose votes will be challenged, challenged by whom, and the criteria of challenge enunciated by whom under this Bush administration, still not fully explained. And then this article, this first appeared over Crooks and Liars. Over the last 3 years, the Republican-controlled state legislatures in Indiana, Georgia, Missouri, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin have all basically passed caging laws, passed laws requiring voters to produce a photo ID and requiring the civil rights groups, measures that the civil rights groups contend were aimed at suppressing minority voting. The Supreme Court is going to look into this, but it goes even farther. In 2004 in Ohio, the new Democratic Secretary of State Jennifer Brunner said in a phone interview that the election law passed last year and signed by former Republican Governor Bob Taft, quote, effectively institutionalized vote caging, end quote. The law requires, this from the Crooks and Liars article, the law requires that the state's 88 county election boards send non-forwardable pre-election notices to all 7.8 million registered Ohio voters at least 60 days before the election. Undeliverable records are public records, said undeliverable letters are public records, she said, meaning that effectively, again, quoting the Secretary of State of Ohio, now the counties are paying for the data needed to compile challenge lists. The Republicans just get these public records, and people show up to vote. They say, you can't vote. You know, we happen to know that you live in a minority district. 27 minutes past the hour. You see everything, you see every part, you see all my light, and you love my dark. You dig everything of which I'm ashamed. There's not anything to which you can't relate. 34 minutes past the hour. The Washington Post, October 29th, 2004. Keep in mind, October 29th is the week before the election of 2004. This is the Washington Post, the week before the election, John Kerry versus George W. Bush. The lead paragraph Republicans yesterday continued to challenge the validity of tens of thousands of voter registrations in Ohio. While a coalition of civil rights and other states in the presidential election, while a coalition of civil rights and labor groups sued the GOP, contending the Republican efforts were aimed at removing eligible minority voters from the rolls. After initially saying he would not contest a Wednesday ruling halting the challenges, Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell, Republican, worked with other election officials who asked the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati to allow GOP challenges to 35,000 voters from mostly urban and minority areas to proceed before the election. Also yesterday, Republicans in Wisconsin attempted to challenge the registrations of 5,600 voters in Milwaukee. The Republican challenges in Ohio, Wisconsin, and other battleground states prompted civil rights and labor unions to sue in U.S. District Court in Newark, saying the GOP is violating a consent decree. Well, apparently they are still doing it and bragging about it. The GOP of Kansas, the head of the grand old party, indeed. The greedy old plutocrats, the head of the GOP in Kansas, John Ashcroft's former attorney, sending out an email to all of his loyal minions going, ain't it cool? We're caging people out crazy here. Actually, he probably doesn't talk like that from Kansas, but 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll free all across the United States. We're live today. It's December 27th here, Thursday, December 27th. And if you want to drop by our live chat room as well, you can go to tomhartman.com, click live chat and drop in and say hello. And Lewis in Aloha, Oregon. Hey, Lewis, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Happy holidays to you.
Well, thank you, and happy upcoming New Year, I guess.
Thank you. I wanted to say that, you know, the importance of the diplomacy that our president shows, he's such a stagehand on top of, you know, the whole world, the whole global world, and everyone looks to our president. You know, and when we try not to make fun of him, but when we say that he doesn't have a diplomatic hand, what we're trying to say is that, you know, the requirement to be president is to show stability and to show diplomacy and, you know, to show peace, that we're trying to be a peaceful nation to all of the world to see. And when he does things that are arrogant and are like a bull in a china shop, it just, you know, sets the stage for other leaders to do the same.
Yeah, but Bush doesn't believe in peace. I mean, look at his history as governor of Texas. He believes in killing people. He thinks that bad people cause problems, and the best solution for bad people is to kill them.
Absolutely, and this is one of the reasons I think, you know, I believe our candidates as Democrats are some of the best candidates we have that will show that diplomacy and will show what a real leader should be when they take that stage and they show that they'll lead by example. And not only that, that they listen to all of the people that have voted for them or against them, that they really sit and think about where the country needs to head and what's best for all. So, yeah. You know, I hope we really think about that when we go to our voting booths and think about, you know, the best candidates that are going to help us all. And you know, as a Democrat, I'm definitely looking at Hillary, but, you know, I'm also looking at what's going to happen in the future so I can make a final decision on it.
Amen. Lewis, I will support, with the exception of Mike Gravel, I will support any Democrat who is the nominee. And Mike Gravel is just a little too crazy for me. But, you know, it's a big tent. But certainly, I think Hillary would make a great president. I think Barack Obama would make a great president. I think John Edwards would make a great president. I think Dennis Kucinich would make a great president. Joe Biden, Chris Dodd. I mean, you go right on down the list. I think that we've got an embarrassment of riches on the Democratic side. And the Republicans, what do they have? Well, they have a little bit of a problem. For example, Mike Huckabee's, this is, again, a YouTube spoof ad for Mike Huckabee.
If you're a Republican voter in Iowa, Mike Huckabee wants you to know that he just got a voicemail from God saying he knows how busy you are during this blessed Christmas season. You have too much to do to even think about what Mike may have said 15 years ago, or who he may have released and who they may have killed 8 years ago. Or
what remember those good old times?
He may not have known about a few days ago. All you have to remember is who Mike Huckabee isn't. Mike isn't a corrupt cross-dressing sex addict from pushy New York City whose friends...
See, here they show a picture of Rudy dressed in drag.
...are all indicted or gay. Mike isn't 178
John
years
McCain.
Old, and he didn't sponsor a bill that would send millions of Mexicans into Iowa to steal your job, do the lambada with your daughter, and make your food taste spicy with their jalapenos. Mike isn't made of plastic.
Mitt Romney.
He doesn't have the soul of a game show host from the 1970s, and there's nothing magic about Mike Huckabee's underwear.
And this is showing the Mormon magic underwear, the temple underwear.
Mike Huckabee, strong conservative, not a crook or a weirdo or a Mormon. Let's leave it at that. Okay? Okay.
And the slogan says, Mike Huckabee, don't look all that close. It's, oh, my. 1-866-303-2270. David in Seattle. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask, isn't it clear that every time they invoke executive privilege, they're guilty?
In my opinion, yeah, I think that that's an admission of guilt, or an admission of, you know, at least smoke, if not fire. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. And the problem is that, you know, in the Supreme Court, in the Nixon case, when Nixon tried to invoke executive privilege, the Supreme Court in, I forget who it was versus Nixon, the people versus Nixon or whatever, ruled that in a criminal case, executive privilege doesn't apply. There's no such thing as executive privilege in a criminal case. And so if you're looking at actual crimes in the Oval Office, in the White House, in the executive branch, the president cannot invoke executive privilege. Executive privilege is, by the way, not in the Constitution. This is something that the Supreme Court came up with, as I recall, in the neighborhood of about 100 years ago, that had to do with foreign policy, very specifically, originally in the Supreme Court ruling, had to do with foreign policy, that the president had the right to have foreign policy advice without those foreign governments ever finding out what was said. And Bush has carried it to a new extreme. I mean, he's Carlos Marcello and Santa Traficante have nothing on this guy, nothing on him. Gene in Napa, California. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind?
Hey. The braggadocio of that GOP official in Kansas who proudly announced the amount of Republican vote caging in Kansas, that's a shocker. Thank you for bringing that.
You're welcome. It was just like Sarah Taylor announcing it before Congress. I think that the Republicans have been doing this thing for the better part of two decades, wiping out minority voters, wiping out urban voters, going into zip codes that they know are heavily Democratic and caging the hell out of them and shoving down the vote, pushing down the vote.
Tom, what worries me so much is that it's the Justice Department corruption and the success of the prosecutor purge. There's nobody out there to prosecute their election fraud crimes, and that's why he's bragging about it. He knows he can now.
No, I think he's bragging about it because he doesn't realize it's a crime, because it is so widespread in the Republican Party. And this is the thing, same thing. Sarah Taylor admitted it, you know, in those hearings, because she didn't realize that it was a crime. I think that this is so widespread in the Republican Party. And I think it's in large part for the reasons that you identified, Gene, that there's nobody to prosecute it. And so Karl Rove is like, hey, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to do a little caging here. I mean, this all goes back to Paul Weyrich. This goes back to Paul Weyrich, the guy, the Republican who brags that he helped bring Ronald Reagan to power, and who for years has been a consultant to Republican candidates, including George W. Bush. And this was 15 or more years ago, Paul Weyrich speaking to a group of Republicans in a church about how the Republicans were going to win elections.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And that's what they've been doing ever since. They've been doing it for 20 years. Kip in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Kip.
Hi, Tom. I just called Senator Bingaman's office here and asked them to get word up to the staff in Washington to get back to me with what Bingaman thinks the Senate can do and what he is doing to put a stop to this, or certainly to publicize and put the brakes on this caging process. What do you think is currently being done that might have some productive results?
The ACLU has some lawsuits on this. The I believe it's the NAACP has some lawsuits going on this. Frankly, though, I think they're all being obstructed. You know, they're all being blocked. And frankly, I think that it's going to take a congressional investigation. So I think, Kip, you know, tip of the hat to you. You did the exact right thing. And, you know, congratulations. Good on you for calling Bingaman's office and for you know, call your elected representatives and tell them, hey, I understand that the head of the GOP in Kansas just sent out an email bragging that they're caging voters. What are you going to do to stop the Republican Party from trying to steal the elections by the use of caging this year? And I would like to hear back from you. Said that's very respectfully to your member of Congress, Democrat or Republican. 45, call congress.org, by the way, I'll get you.
But if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero. For this town he's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say you've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on a string. Never compromise what's right and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything.
866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, participate on the blog on our front page or our message boards, and AirAmerica.com. If you want to participate in the blog there, click on the Tom Hartmann page. Ken in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Well, I think that the only way we can regain power is to out-rove Karl Rove. I know you disagree with that principle, but these people just laugh at us. They laugh about our conferences, about calling and writing. I keep thinking back to this horse's head scene in the Godfather, and I hate to say it, but they are just not going to relinquish their economic power, their political power, unless somebody puts the fear of God in them. And I don't see any other way except to do our version of harassment and dirty tricks.
I strongly disagree. I would submit to you that that's not what brought down the mafia. That's not what brought down, that's not what put Carlos Marcello in prison. That's not, you know, the way to put the fear of God in them, and I agree with you that that needs to be done, is to enforce the law. And that means that we have to encourage the Democrats in Congress, who have actually the ability to enforce the law, to be doing so. This is the thing that boggles my mind, is why don't we have special prosecutors? Why are there so few hearings going on? I mean, you've got a couple, but so few. You know, Wexler wants hearings.com. I mean, you've got a couple of people who are calling for these kind of things, but I agree with you. We need to scare them, but you're not going to defeat criminals by becoming a criminal. You defeat criminals by enforcing the law.
Well, it just doesn't seem to be working to this point. Karl Rove and Tom DeLay are back to their old tricks.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's not working because we're not enforcing the law. So we need to be telling our elected representatives, Democratic and Republican, we want you to enforce the law. We want you to investigate these guys. There is so much evidence of crimes just laying around on the ground here by the Republican Party and the machine associated with George W. Bush that these this is the problem. You call up and you say, you know, I'm mad as hell, or I want you to impeach, or something like that, and immediately you get discounted as, oh, it's another guy who's just, you know, he's off his rails. And you and I know that we're not off our rails. But that, I'm sorry, that's how the congressional staff views it, is, oh, yeah, it's one of them. Whereas if you call and say very reasonably, you know, the chairman of the Kansas GOP just sent out an email saying that they're doing vote caging in Kansas. And as I understand it, the Republican Party for 20 years has had a restraining order preventing them from doing this. And yet they did it in Ohio. They did it in Florida. They're doing it in Kansas. They're bragging about it. When are you In my case, it would be, when are you, Darlene Hooley, Congresswoman Darlene Hooley? When are you, Senator Gordon Smith? When are you, Senator Ron Wyden? Those are my two senators and my member of the House of Representatives. When are you going to initiate some investigations into this, or when are you going to work with your colleagues to try to investigate these clear crimes being committed by the Republican Party and the Bush administration? Ed in Arlington, Washington. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. You were just talking about what I was going to mention, why isn't anything being done. But an analogy came to me just as I was listening. It's like we're in the schoolyard, and there's a gang of schoolyard bullies running around beating up everybody, saying, yeah, 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 I dare you to do anything. So a couple of brave kids go in, and they tell the teachers, and the teachers themselves say, oh, well, we'll take care of it. But they do nothing because the bullies beat them up, too. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel.
Yeah.
No matter what we do, I've been calling my senators and congressmen ever since I started listening to your show 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I the only person that ever gets back to me is Patty Murray, but then it's a form letter, and you know.
Yeah, but at least she's getting back. The fact of the matter is, Ed, that our individual calls, you know, they're not going to, as one individual. One individual call. You're not, you know, I mean, you're talking about elected officials who have a relatively limited budget and a limited staff, and they're probably getting a few hundred calls and emails and letters a day at the very least. Some of them, in the case of like Harry Reid or Nancy Pelosi, are getting thousands to tens of thousands a day, depending on the day. So it's not like we should be depressed because we don't get an individual response. It's a vote, essentially. When you call your member of Congress, you should think of it as a vote. You know, particularly if they actually hear what you're saying, as opposed to just, you know, kind of screaming at them or something. And so I would encourage you to keep doing it. I think it's marvelous that you're doing it. And I'll tell you, you know, as Bernie Sanders points out every week on this program, they do pay attention to those things, even if it seems that they don't. And when the tide turns, when they start getting overwhelming numbers of people calling them, and this is why I put all the toll-free numbers I could find for Congress up on our website over at callcongress.org. When a large number of people start calling them, they will start taking it seriously. They really have no choice. Ed, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Bob in San Jose. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, I was commenting on earlier. We're talking about the various crimes and things, and I'm wondering, can we have some sort of a commission, in, not necessarily through Congress, but just get together and we talk about the war crimes that have been committed by the folks here? I mean, those videotapes, if I understand it, show people actually being waterboarded.
Right. Absolutely. If you want to have the force of law, you're going to have an agency of government because the force of law comes from government.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is we make it public. People see what this is about. I mean,
but you don't have the tapes and you don't have the testimony.
People in other parts of the world see that, but we understand what's going on here.
But you don't have the tapes. You don't have the testimony. You could have a public forum. You know, it's sort of like, you know, the old Country Joe and the Fish. What if they had a war and nobody came? I mean, the press probably would not pay attention to it. I mean, it's possible that an organization like the ACLU or MoveOn.org or some high-profile organization could do something like this, like political theater. And I would encourage that. I would encourage them to do so. But really what we need to do is we need to have legal investigations by legally empowered people to legally investigate crimes. And that can be done only by two branches of government, the legislative or the executive.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program here. Tim Carpenter on the line with us. He's the National Director of Progressive Democrats of America, mobilizing the progressive vote. PDAmerica.org, the website. Tim, welcome to the program. Oh, hang on just a second here. Let me put you on the air, Tim. That always helps, doesn't it? Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. How are you? Thanks for the opportunity.
Just great. Great to have you here with us. There's a lot of stuff on your website and that you guys are up to that I wanted to talk with you about. But number one, we've been talking about voter caging and how the Republicans are suppressing the vote all over the United States and have been for the better part of two decades. What are Progressive Democrats of America doing to get out the vote?
Well, we were launched, Tom, around the whole Ohio crisis and been organizing and mobilized to make sure that we get our progressive vote counted as it's cast. So we're organizing currently across the country to make sure that our message is heard, and we're doing that in a very simple way. We're bird-dogging the presidential candidates with our progressive platform and asking them to take it. So it's a grassroots effort, working through the website in our neighborhoods to take our progressive measures neighbor to neighbor, door to door.
Right. Okay. So you're talking to the candidates and you're talking to individual voters and making sure that they're on the voting rolls, that they're going to vote, that they're going to participate, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Kitchen table conversations and taking that out into our neighborhoods and into our labor hall schools and synagogues and churches.
Right. PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. You guys have endorsed some politicians here. I see the 14th District of Illinois, for example. This is really getting down at the level of the ground.
Well, we were launched with the belief, Tom, that we had to challenge the centrist Democrats, as you do every day on your radio station. We've got to take on the DCCC candidates, the DLC candidates. We're one of the first organizations that really this last election cycle were engaged in taking on incumbents in the primaries. We began in 2006 taking on Jane Harman with Marcy Winograd, and we're at it again this election cycle where we'll be taking on Al Wynn out of Maryland. And as you said, the special election with the former speaker retiring, there's a special election out in Chicago, and John Lesch is a great candidate who ran last time, and we have an opportunity in February to elect him, and then hopefully in March send him on to Congress for 2 years.
Yeah. What's your take on what's happening with the Democratic presidential primaries? Is there a position that Progressive Democrats of America are taking, or I know you did an online poll a while back, and I want to talk to you about that in just a second, but broadly.
Well, number one, most importantly, we have to understand that this election cycle, we're not going to get a progressive majority to govern. It's one thing, as we saw last election, to get a majority of Democrats elected, but until we get a progressive majority elected, we've got a lot of work to do. So this presidential season allows us the opportunity to take a broad-based progressive platform to the candidates and hold them accountable. Early this month in December, as you said, we did our straw poll, and not a real surprise, two-thirds of the Progressive Democrat of America voters voted for the progressive candidates, whether it be Dennis Kucinich or John Edwards. So we're really working with Dennis Kucinich on the ground with his message, which is an important message. But realistically, in Iowa, we think that John Edwards is going to make the breakthrough. We believe that he's going to win there and continue to move forward into New Hampshire. So a lot of our members are really engaged on the grassroots level with John Edwards right now.
Right, yeah. It's something I've noticed. We do every other week or so. We've been doing our Tom Hartman program straw poll, you know, to see who would you vote for in the Democratic primary. And one of the things that I discovered early on, this was maybe 2.5 months ago when we first started doing this, was that if I announced a half hour or an hour in advance that I was going to do the straw poll, then did it, Dennis Kucinich won. And what was so odd was that we would open the lines for about 8 minutes, you know, one segment, 8, 9, 10 minutes. And I would just, you know, put people on the line, click, 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 you know, just going through. I'd call out their area code and say, who would you vote for? But we would be having calls that would last for up to 2 hours of people calling, I'm calling to vote for Dennis Kucinich. And if our call screener said, are you listening to the show? They'd say, no, I'm just calling to vote. Whereas if I don't announce in advance that I'm going to do this straw poll, then Edwards always wins. And during the last 3 minutes or so, it starts becoming about 80% Kucinich, just during the last 2 or 3 minutes out of that 10 minutes. And then for another hour and a half, we have all these Kucinich calls, again, of people who are not listening to the program. And I'm just amazed by the competence of the Dennis Kucinich web net roots. I mean, you know, they're really out there to slam these polls. On the other hand, we've had to stop announcing when we're doing the straw polls to try and get an accurate assessment of what our listeners want, you know, so that we're not, you know, part of some giant, you know, web-based campaign. You want to speak to that?
Well, sure. What we attempted to do, Tom, is we froze our membership. We announced that we were going to have a straw poll, and we announced that we would only allow those folks that were already registered on the PDA site to vote. So we wanted a real authentic snapshot of where our base was, and it's no surprise that 41% of them voted for Dennis and 26% voted for John Edwards. As you said, the Kucinich folks are well organized on the web. They do a great job, but we don't really want to game a poll. We want to have a real...
But when you were doing your poll, I must have gotten 20 emails from people saying, go over to Progressive Democrats right now and vote for Kucinich. I didn't get one saying, go vote for Edwards, or anybody else for that matter.
Well, they as you said, they've really worked it hard. The Kucinich campaign, while...
And I'm not being, by the way, I'm not being critical of the Kucinich campaign for this. These are the ways that you win campaigns. I tip my hat to them. I'm astounded that more of the Democratic candidates aren't doing this kind of thing, frankly.
Well, again, I'm not too surprised with the results when the Kucinich folks do get mobilized. Yeah, I was wondering why the Edwards folks weren't working as hard as Dennis. They did a national poll, and as you said, you got a number of phone calls. They're well organized. It's no surprised that Dennis won the DFA poll, won the Progressive Democrat America, won the nation poll. The base out there is with Dennis. The problem, of course, as you know better than anybody, is he can't make that breakthrough, and he's obviously not going to be the nominee. But it's important that that message, that's why we organized progressive2008.org, the website, to carry that platform forward. While Dennis, the person, may not be successful, that platform in which Dennis is running from, which John Edwards will carry through, is going to win ultimately, and that's our belief and why we're organizing around it.
Yeah, I agree. And this is, I was only giving money to the Edwards campaign, although I'm not endorsing anybody. I mean, as I've said, I will work to get elected any Democrat, including Hillary Clinton, who everybody seems to think is, not everybody, but, you know, many of the listeners to our program are like, oh my God, you know, I'm not so worried, frankly, about Hillary Clinton. I think that if enough of us got active, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was not elected as the big progressive. He was elected as a centrist. Teddy Roosevelt was elected as the rich white guy who was going to protect corporate interests. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was not elected to end slavery, and Lyndon Johnson was a right-wing cracker from the South who certainly was not elected on a civil rights platform. And yet every one of those people changed America in a positive way because the people forced them to. And
yep.
And that's where I'm at. But anyway, I wanted to say, I started out just, you know, giving money to the Edwards campaign, which I've done a number of times. And then I thought, you know, it's so important, even though I don't think that Dennis Kucinich has a chance of becoming the nominee, I think it's so important that he be there speaking out that I started giving money to the Kucinich campaign as well.
Well, that's why we're running on both tracks. We're on the ground in Iowa today for John Edwards, and we're out in New Hampshire making phone calls for Dennis. We'll be having our town hall meeting on the question of impeachment and the progressive platform on January 6th out in Keene. So we're going to continue to organize and mobilize around both of those candidates and move that platform. I think at the end of the day, as you said, Tom, the most important thing is to ensure that the platform, progressive platform, resonates through all of the candidates. Dennis was successful in 2004 to get many of the candidates to adopt the platform of ending the occupation, single-payer health care, and he's doing that again. So it's important that he continue that role.
Frankly, I think he did it in 2000. I mean, I lived in Vermont for 10 years. I don't know Howard Dean as a friend, but I know Howard Dean. And when he started the race in 2000, he was a moderate, he was a centrist Democrat. And after standing next to Dennis Kucinich for a half a dozen debates, he had become a progressive.
Well, there's no doubt that Howard Dean definitely hijacked the anti-war message in 2004. Dennis was that authentic voice. We were founded, Progressive Democrats of America, many of us who were very active in both the Dean and the Kucinich campaign, to bring that spirit and that energy forward.
Yeah, I said 2000, I meant 2004. Thank you for correcting me. So what can people do right now? We have just a few seconds left.
Well, real quick, Tom, if folks can just go to pdamerica.org, get registered so we can keep in touch with you. At the top of our website, you'll see progressive2008.org, which will take you to another website where we're working with Healthcare Now, with peaceactiondemocrats.com, around this platform we spoke of, a seven-issue platform that unites progressives. Download those cards, take them to your neighbors, get them out to the candidates, and be part of the growing progressive movement.
Yeah, sounds like a good plan. As a starting point, become part of it. And do you have local chapters? Is there an opportunity for people to socially get together?
Absolutely. Again, if you go to the website, get registered, we'll let you know where in your neighborhoods. We have 130 chapters. There's a menu right on the pull-down menu where you can find in your state where folks are organized. We're organized by congressional district. Our goal is to organize 435 congressional districts, as you said, Tom, to take our message to our Congress members and to keep working until we elect a progressive majority of Democrats. And during the recess, we'll be visiting our congressional members, and we hope folks on this will be part of it.
Great. Well said. Tim Carpenter, he is the executive director of Big Cheese.
Progressive Democrats of America.
National director, yeah, Progressive Democrats of America. PDAmerica.org, the website. Get over there, sign up. Tim, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom.
And keep up the great work. 16 minutes past the hour. Our quote for the day from Ben Franklin. Be always at war with your vices, at peace with your neighbors, and let each new year find you a better man. And a nice sentiment from Ben Franklin. Our number for the day, 141,387. As of 1 o'clock today, Eastern Time, that would have been about, an hour and a half ago, more or less. The 141,387 Americans had signed on for Robert Wexler's online petition demanding congressional impeachment hearings. into Dick Cheney, Vice President Dick Cheney. So Wexler's call for impeachment hearings, you know, out there doing well. WexlerWantsHearings.com, the website, so check it out. Rob Call is with us. He is the editor, chief cook and bottle washer, founder, president. I don't know. What's your official title there, Rob?
Executive publisher.
Oh, man, that's cool. And opednews.com. And one of the best sources for op-eds out there. Rob, what are you seeing over at opednews.com as the big story of the day or the big stories of the day?
The big stories. Well, you know, the big stories, of course, is Iowa. What's interesting in Iowa is a poll that came out that none of the media really interpreted in a way that I think is pretty interesting. And we've had a lot of interest here at Op-Ed News in Ron Paul. Progressives are interested in him. People who are so disgusted with the do-nothing Democrats that they're looking at a guy and ignoring his libertarian liabilities and liking what they see in terms of what he has to say about habeas corpus and ending the war. And what was interesting is this new poll that came out. It basically, Paul jumped from 4% to 10%. Now, that's not huge. It puts him behind.
Is this the national Republican primary voters?
No, this is Iowa.
This is Iowa Republican primary voters. Ron Paul has jumped to 10% into double digits.
Yeah, and the double digits is cool, but there's a 4% margin of error, and Giuliani is at 14%, and McCain is at 17%. So that literally, statistically, they're in a dead heat.
Hmm.
And nobody in the mainstream media has made that conclusion.
No, the corporate media would never talk about those things.
So basically, Ron Paul is head-to-head with the two people who in New Hampshire are considered the McCain's top runner in New Hampshire. Giuliani is kind of crashing a bit anyway. But
yeah,
that's pretty wild stuff for Ron Paul.
It is. It is. What do you see over at Op-Ed News as perhaps the underreported, but maybe we should know about it, stories of the day?
Well,
or the interesting,
one is that the Lakota Nation is seceding from the United States.
Can they do that?
They're trying. We've got one of our reporters, one of our editors, actually, has been interviewing the leadership there, and they're disgusted with the broken promises. And the federal government is now trying to get them to sign another agreement that will cede more of their land again.
Is this in the Dakotas?
This is the Lakota Sioux.
Right.
L-A-K-O-T-A.
No, I understand that. I thought that they were located in the Dakotas, though. Maybe I'm geographically challenged here.
I think that they're kind of spread around the Dakotas and Montana, Wyoming, maybe that area.
Yeah. Wherever they may be. In any case, they're trying to secede from the United States.
Yes.
That's going to be an interesting one to follow.
Yeah, if anybody wants to check it out, they just have to plug in Lakota into our search. It may not be at the very top of the page, but I think that's fascinating, and that's a continuing story we're covering that I think we're somewhat exclusive on, and we're certainly getting our own original content on that, you know, in terms of the interviews that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what else going on over?
Well, we've got another one of our writers has been covering New Orleans, and the series title is Baghdad on the Bayou.
Mm-hmm.
And the story there is that basically George Bush had his people do the same thing in New Orleans after the hurricane that he had them do in Iraq.
Sure, it's Naomi Klein's shock doctrine.
Pardon me?
It's shock doctrine. It's disaster capitalism. It's doing what the people would never allow you to do if they had a say in it, but doing it because you've got a disaster so that you now have an opportunity to come in and privatize the schools.
Well, I feel very good that the article series, which started in the beginning of the month before Naomi Klein wrote about disaster capitalism in New Orleans, was talking directly about that.
Yeah, that's great.
The thing that the U.S. did in Iraq before they did even that, before they did anything else, was secure the oil fields.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know that before they took care of the people who were dying in New Orleans, that's what they did there, too.
They were securing the oil.
They were securing the oil.
Wow. Wow. What do you see coming down the road here? We just have a minute or so left. What do you see coming down the road here, Rob?
Oh, it's election season.
Yeah.
I see that anybody that scares the powers that be getting vilified and mocked and laughed at in the mainstream media. They're going to pull Howard Deans left and right after Iowa. You're going to see the same exact kind of thing that happened to Howard Dean. They're going to start doing it to Ron Paul, Huckabee, Edwards, anybody other than probably Romney and Hillary.
Yeah, interesting. Rob Call, opednews.com, the website. Rob, thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Good talking with you, Rob. 27 minutes past the hour. Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States, tomhartman.com, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. One of the folks in the chat room just a minute ago said, hey, Tom, any new thoughts or ideas? This was from Fecklar. Any new ideas or thoughts on Pakistan? And my response was, when I look at the spot price of gold, right now, I see gold is up maybe, I don't know, $6, $8, $10, something like that over the last 24 hours. If this was an Archduke Ferdinand moment, if the powers that be of the world, the real savvy insiders, thought that the assassination of Benazir Bhutto was going to be something that was going to just explode the Middle East or Pakistan, just for that matter, I suspect that gold would be up $30, $40, $50, $100, something like that. It seems that I've just noticed this over the years that whenever there is a major international incident that a lot of people suspect is going to provoke more and more instability, that gold spikes. And so I'm just keeping an eye on it. But right now, it's a tragedy. It's a terrible tragedy. It's we've all the speculation that we had in the first hour of this program and the details. We're just going to have to stand on that, I think, for the moment and wait and see what happens. Della in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Della, welcome to the program.
Hello,
thanks for calling.
Hello. Happy New Year to you.
Well,
now,
thank you.
You know, I listened to a rebroadcast of your program at the Strand Bookstore, and one woman there called out and said, oh, but Clinton, he eliminated the deficit, didn't he? And, of course, we know how he eliminated the deficit, because the stock market tripled during his presidency, and he never boasts about this. You never hear him say that the stock market went from 3,000 to 10,000 during his years, but that's because when people lose jobs, the stock market goes up, and people lost their jobs to NAFTA. That's
yeah.
What happened. He made the stock market rich. He made Robert Rubin and all the stockholders the 10% of the people who own 85% of the stock, they benefited on the backs of people who lost their jobs. So you never hear him talk about that. Now, as far as what you said earlier about, oh, if Hillary were elected, she would listen to the voice of the people. She would be more progressive. More
no, that's
progressive.
Not what I said. Excuse me, Della. That's not what I said. What I said was we have to speak out loudly enough that our elected officials have no choice but to listen to us. I did not say that I think that it is, in Hillary's DNA to listen to the people. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. So,
yes.
Look at
Lieberman. Lieberman hasn't listened to the voices of the people. They're speaking out loudly when they voted for
Lieberman
Ned
was
Lamont.
Listening to the voices of the Republicans.
They're listening to the voices of Republicans, but the people voted for Ned Lamont, and they spoke out against the war, and yet he is coming out in support of McCain, and he really should be recalled by those people in Connecticut.
Well, Della, I don't disagree with you, but the majority of the people who were voting in Connecticut voted for Lieberman, ultimately, at the end of the day. I mean, Lieberman basically forged this coalition, and frankly, I think that this is one of the things that is being used by the Republicans to... Blackmail is probably too strong a word, but to threaten Harry Reid is the possibility that Joe Lieberman will jump ship. If Joe Lieberman declares that he's going to caucus with the Republicans, suddenly the Senate becomes Republican, and Harry Reid loses his job. I mean, that's a mind-boggling amount of power. And so, anyway, 1-866-303-2270. Susanna in Tarrytown, New York. Hey, Susanna.
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have two comments. First, I think that the whole concept of this primary being so early because of advertising is clouding over our awareness. There's so many other, like, important issues in the world scene that are taking place. And I know Randy Rhodes has mentioned that about the whole fact that the whole primary discussion is happening so early that I think there's really something wrong with that because it's obscuring a lot of other things. But the second thing is that, you know, do you feel that possibly when you get to the real high, high points of power in this country that Democrat or Republican doesn't matter, that you have to just bow to the corporate interests? I mean,
yes.
Is there a point at which it doesn't really matter at this point? And how much
it is, let me say, it is the rare person. You're welcome. Thank you, Susanna. It is the rare person who doesn't bow to the powers in this country. And frankly, LBJ ultimately reached the point where he said no. And Jack Kennedy, in some ways, reached a point where he said no. And in a large way, Franklin Roosevelt really was the last guy who stood up to the corporate powers in the United States and stood up in a really, really seriously significant way as president of the United States. And part of the problem, again, you know, goes back to Buckley versus Vallejo, the Supreme Court decision in 1976 that said that it's okay, you know, that money is speech and you can't stop money from flowing into political campaigns. And we need significant campaign finance reform, and we frankly need a Supreme Court that will reverse the Buckley decision, among others. First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti is another one. You know, there's been several decisions that happened in the 70s and 80s and 90s that enhanced corporate power, enhanced the power of the very wealthy. And so you have a situation where somebody like, for example, Michael Bloomberg can and probably will, I guess depending on who the nominees are, may run for president and just pull $1 billion out of his back pocket. I mean, he said, you know, a guy who dies rich is a stupid person, you know, could pull $1 billion out of his back pocket and run for president and outspend anybody. Is that, you know, the American ideal, that the richest guy gets to be the president? Well, you know, Michael Bloomberg might be a great guy. I frankly don't know his positions. My best friend is a Democrat who's lived his whole life in New York City and likes Michael Bloomberg. I don't know. But is it the American way? No, I don't think so. As to the issue of the primaries being too early, number one, I agree that they're too early. Yeah, I mean, you look at like England, where there's a £100,000 limit on how much, about almost $200,000 limit on how much you can spend in an election campaign. So how long do the campaigns last? A few weeks. So, you know, we could take a tip from that, except for the fact that you've got these Supreme Court decisions saying, no, you can't limit the cash going into the campaign. But the larger thing that concerns me, frankly, is not how early they are, because in a way, if the press, if the corporate media would deal with issues, then having the primaries this early would be a great opportunity to spend a year and a half educating the American people about the issues. But instead, it's all about the horse race. And that's where I think the disservice is being done to the United States. Ken in Long Beach, California. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Tom. Let me quickly say that when horse race, you just said, I also listen to some conservative talk shows, and they really are interested in the horse race. They don't seem to be at all interested in what's going on in Washington today. But my main reason for calling was I called my representative's office here in the Long Beach area. Mm-hmm. And the man I talked to there didn't seem to know anything about caging, had no idea what I was talking about, and didn't know anything about Republicans not, you know, supposed to be, the judgment against it. And, of course,
restraining order.
About this Kansas thing you were talking about. So what can I do to show him something? Is there a site where we can see this information in Kansas?
Yeah, if you go over to Daily Kos right now, there's, you know, one of the top threads on Daily Kos is this story, and it's got links back into the 2004 story in the Washington Post about it. It's got links to a variety of background sources. It's very well done post over at the Daily Kos, and I don't have it up right in front of me right now, so I can't tell you who the diarist was there.
Something more recent than 2004.
Oh yeah, no. They're referring to this email newsletter that was sent out 3 or 4 days ago by the chairman of the Republican Party in Kansas, saying that we are caging voters successfully, thousands of them. We're knocking thousands of voters off the rolls. Aren't we wonderful?
Okay.
And And, you know, the 2004 article is about all the lawsuits against the Republicans that who used caging to steal the 2004 election. And it references also the restraining order against the Republican Party that goes back to the 1980s. The Republican Party is in violation of multiple laws and court orders. And has been for a long time. The problem is that who prosecutes these things? The Justice Department. And who does the Justice Department work for? George Bush. It's part of the executive branch of government. And that's why the legislative branch of government, which does have the power for independent oversight and investigation, needs to get their butt in gear. And that's why it's such an important thing, Ken, that you called your representative, and you might want to go over to Daily Kos, and it's probably going to make its way over to other progressive websites soon as the day goes on. Go over to Daily Kos and read that diary, read some of those links, maybe print some of them out, and you know, take them down to your local your member of Congress's office.
My problem is going to be that this Republican does not want to believe anything that came out of liberal media, such as you and Kos.
Well, you know, the Kos is linking to this came out of the Republican Party in Kansas. I mean, this is the email from the GOP, the head of the GOP in Kansas, number one. And number two, the article in the Washington Post, which, I don't know, maybe this Republican thinks is the liberal media. But you know, if you have a Republican member of the House of Representatives who is saying that they don't know what caging is, I mean, I could get it that a staff member probably doesn't, and that's who you talked to.
Yeah, the staff member I talked to.
Yeah. Well, you educated a staff member. That's a starting point. You might also want to call your two senators. You're calling from California. You have two Democratic senators, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. Call them and say, you know, why aren't you guys looking into caging? You know, here you've got the head of the Kansas Republican Party today bragging about the fact that they're caging voters. This is something the Senate should be looking into.
What was the HR number on the bill that Rohrabacher, my representative, and Kucinich voted, the only ones who voted against it? Was it 1955?
Yeah, I believe so. If you're talking about the one, the thought crimes bill.
Thought crime,
1955.
I hadn't heard of that either.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Ken. Good talking with you. Thanks, and thanks for calling your member of Congress. 45 minutes past the hour.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on the wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. See those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the squares, a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore.
9 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270. John in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Your caller a couple of callers ago was talking about, I don't want to be a Clinton apologist, but she was talking about how, you know, we're reaping the benefits of Clinton's policies and everything. That may be true to some extent, but I recall during his administration, he took on the Fed and the conventional wisdom when unemployment was creeping below 5%. They always claimed that this was, a threshold we didn't want to cross because it was inflationary. And he said, hey, we've never done it. You know, let's try it. And we had, you know, as close to full employment as we've had, there was an unleashing of entrepreneurial spirit in small business, and I contend that there was more genuine wealth created in that period of time than we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, well, it may be in the context of the previous 20 years.
Yeah.
I wouldn't disagree with you. I'd say in the context of the last 70 years, I would strongly disagree with that statement.
Well,
because Clinton
within the context of the last within the last two or three administrations.
Yeah, because Clinton was continuing many of the policies that Reagan put into place. He was not enforcing the Sherman Act. He wasn't stopping mergers and acquisitions.
Absolutely.
And he was promoting international trade policies that were exporting our jobs. And you know, I mean, there were some good things that Bill Clinton did, and he was, I frankly think, a decent man and not a terrible president. But he was, I mean, let's just say what it is. Bill Clinton was, you know, right up there with Dwight Eisenhower as a reasonable moderate, Republican. You know, he was the best Republican president of the 20th century, maybe second to Dwight Eisenhower.
When he did challenge that 5% threshold, that made a big impression on me.
But he didn't have the power to do that. I mean, it was up to Alan Greenspan at the end of the day. Was it 97? I think it was. Greenspan said to the Wall Street Journal that his job was to maintain a certain level of worker insecurity so that there wouldn't be wage inflation and there wouldn't be, you know, the rabble out there in the streets, basically, you know, strikes and things like that. And that was that threshold that you're talking about, that when unemployment started creeping down, the Fed would jack up interest rates to induce a minor recession to increase the inflation rate.
Right.
But that's not a power that the president has.
He said something. You know, he said, you know, let's try it. We haven't done this. You know, this has been
Greenspan did it.
Greenspan went ahead, and you're saying he went ahead and raised.
I'm saying I don't remember that specific incident. Mm-hmm. that broadly over the roughly 20 years Greenspan was head of the Fed, that you know he was quite, you know, bragging about it essentially in his autobiography, talking about how, you know, he maintained low inflation, and mm-hmm. the only inflation that he was concerned about was wage inflation. He
right.
didn't look at the cost of energy, he didn't look at the cost of housing, he didn't look at, you know, a whole lot of other things, and he certainly didn't look at CEO salary increases. He was only concerned with worker inflation. And that,
well, right. I just wanted to,
yeah.
you know.
But if Bill Clinton stood up to him, I say good on him. You know, let me tip my hat to him. So, John, thanks a lot for the call and for, you know, maybe setting the record straight. Craig in San Jose, California. Craig, you want to tell me I'm wrong, too. So.
Well, not really. I'm a big fan. I just had a clarification to offer on
okay.
Buckley versus Vallejo. It does have problems, but it wasn't all bad. It did two things that were good. One was it upheld the constitutionality of public financing of campaigns.
But it had to be voluntary.
Well, exactly. But
it said you cannot have forced public financing. You can only have voluntary public
right.
financing.
All the successful systems around the country, you know, are voluntary.
Right.
The other thing that it did was it said that campaign contributions were not protected speech and could be limited.
Yes. Yeah.
So, it, you know, it wasn't all bad.
Okay. All righty.
Hey, thanks very much.
Point,
keep up the good
point
work.
Taken. Craig,
bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Rick in Greeley, Colorado. You like Hillary Clinton?
I do like Hillary Clinton. Tom, thank you very much for putting me on. It's Rick Silverman, yes, in Greeley, Colorado. I'm out here in the snow, as your screener knows. And I was instructed to call you because I heard that conversation with the director of Progressive Democrats. And you said to him, well, I wouldn't be so unhappy with Hillary Clinton or something to that effect.
I've been saying this all along. She's not my first choice, but if she's the nominee, I will work to get her elected.
Yeah. Well, she's my first choice at the moment. I like her experience, and I was listening the other day when Norman Goldman was challenging some folks who were Hillary supporters as to what she's done. And I recall, for example, that the SCHIP program is something that she was influential in starting during her husband's administration. She's certainly done a number of things that have been very good for residents of the state of New York. I don't need to go into them because they're available at her website.
Yeah, and she's in her second term in the United States Senate. It's Jack Kennedy, when he was elected, he had served, as I recall, three terms in the House, and he was in his second term in the Senate. I mean, he had some experience under his belt. And,
yeah,
and I like
that experience. And I also like the role that she's played historically in education and in getting funds for children's rights and social justice and so forth.
Yep. No, Rick, I got it. And you know, I salute you for having a candidate that you like. I think that that's an important thing. And, you know, the other thing is I think it would be a very good and useful thing to have a woman as president of the United States. Coming up on our program tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls as he does every Friday at noon. It's our Anything Goes Friday. After that, we'll be taking your calls on any topic. That and more right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And never forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.